Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa City County Library's Chapters fundraiser is just around the corner. Chapters features three writers from different genres of writing, reading, and talking about their work to raise money and awareness for the library's Ruth G. Hardman Adult Literacy Program. The September 8th event will feature Roseanne Bittner, a Western romance novelist, Allison Galen, a suspense and mystery novelist, and my guest today, Oklahoma native Alton Carter, an Oklahoma Book Award-winning author for young adult literature. His account of his youth is both searing and depressing, yet uplifting, as he recounts his determination to escape a fate that snares too many children born into abject poverty. In his book, The Boy Who Carried Bricks, Carter describes his desire for a, quote, normal life, unquote, a life devoid of abandonment, neglect, abuse, infestation, and a family and a child welfare system that repeatedly failed him. Here's an excerpt from the book.
Chapter 1, The Beginning. My birth certificate says Glendola Carter gave birth to me in Stillwater, Oklahoma on September 27, 1970. My full name is Alton Odell Carter. The place on the birth certificate where my father's name should be is blank. I don't remember my life as an infant, but by 1974 I was 4 years old and some things about my childhood were as clear as glass. My mother had five children by four different men. We all carried my mother's maiden name of Carter, so I can only assume she was never married to any of our dads. What I do know is none of the men stuck around to help take care of us, let alone give us their last name. My brother Lavelle was the oldest by 2 years, then me, and after me in quick succession came the twins, Keisha and Wattell, and then the baby, Dijon. Four kids in 4 years between shifts at fast food restaurants and various odd jobs. Mom left Lavelle, 5 years old at the time, in charge of us while she worked. Our life was far from ideal, and then Mom started dating again. For whatever reason, she never kept a boyfriend long. The musical boyfriend chairs continued for about 2 years until she finally met a guy named Ray. I remember Ray as a guy of medium height with a medium-length afro. He seemed to like Mom, and they got along pretty well. My brothers and sisters and I called him Raby. For the most part, he treated us well, too, considering we weren't his kids. He never did much with us, but he did spend a lot of time with Mom. In 1975, after dating 4 months, Mom and Ray married. We moved from the university town of Stillwater, about 26 miles northwest, to Perry, Oklahoma, where Ray had grown up. We lived in a house on the east side of town near the railroad tracks. It was a little white, one-bedroom, shotgun-style home, but we were proud of it. The little house sat on a corner lot with a huge oak tree in the front yard. Train tracks ran behind the house, right beyond our big backyard where we spent most of our time playing. When we weren't in the backyard, you could find us on the railroad tracks. We had contests to see who could walk the farthest on a single track. With our arms out to the side to help us balance, we walked the rail for what seemed like miles. When a train came, we would jump off to the side and watch it go by. The trains were loud, enormous, and miles long. I never understood how the engine in back could push all those cars, much less push them so fast and so far.
That was Studio Tulsa producer Scott Gregory reading an excerpt from The Boy Who Carried Bricks. Today, Alton Carter is a former police officer and a youth minister in his hometown of Stillwater and is at work on a follow-up memoir titled Aging Out. Alton Carter is my guest today. Alton Carter, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
And thanks for sharing the story, this remarkable story that you lived growing up in The Boy Who Carried Bricks. What made you decide to write about this story?
Well, I traveled and told my story at camps, and every time I would go speak somewhere, I'd run into somebody that could relate. And so I thought, well, I need to write a book. And after encouragement from a few people, I decided to write it.
This story is your story, the story of growing up in a succession of foster homes, in shelters, raised by abusive family members, moving back and forth from mother to grandmother, and really away from your mother for most of your life growing up. What was your earliest memories of something that should be alien to growing up that you took as natural?
Probably bugs and roaches. You know, some of my craziest memories are going to the doctor, getting bugs out of our ears, and, you know, just coming home hungry or going to school hungry all the time just felt like it wasn't right. And so those are probably the earliest memories I had were of those experiences.
Now, your mother you had an older brother who was a couple of years older, right?
Yes.
And then several brothers that were younger. Mm-hmm. Four different fathers. No father really sticking around except for one sort of common law relationship that ended pretty badly with you literally walking from Perry, Oklahoma to Stillwater. What were your memories of that time?
You know, desperation. Watched, you know, as bad as we felt like we were abused. The hardest part was watching Mom go through that. She never really said anything, but just watching her body language and how she felt about herself was probably what sticks out more than anything else. The walk, we had no idea what to expect or what was going to happen when we got to Stillwater, but just that, as an adult now, that's the hard part, is seeing what my mom went through as a female with five children.
And this came after quite a bit of abuse from this man that was in your life. And one of the things you talked about was, you said you woke up every morning hoping that everything was going to be different. And occasionally it seemed like it was. And those sort of days were the things that gave you hope as a very young child. You said one day this man brought home big wheels and bicycles for you. And it was like, you know, you woke up when you had a day like that, you said, maybe things are going to be different. And inevitably, whether it was drinking or drugs or just meanness, he was beating on both your mother and the children.
You know, watching those things, or, you know, looking back, it was, we did hope. But at the same time, I think in reality, we knew it wasn't going to last very long. So those moments of riding bikes and laughing and playing in the front yard with, like what normal kids did, we knew it would only last for a short time because that's all we'd ever seen. We had never seen months of happiness. It was always despair and hurt and pain and yet trying to watch my mom survive. And, you know, even as kids, you question, you know, you watched your mom care about somebody, but you question why, you know, why do you do this?
What was it like writing about that experience? I imagine it was pretty tough.
You know, it was, and I just kept telling myself over and over again that there's hundreds of thousands of kids out there going through the same thing. And so it made me relive a lot of those issues. In fact, after the book was out, I went to counseling just to deal with some of those issues. I didn't want to resurface and be angry. So I went to counseling for about 2.5 months to just make sure that I was going to be okay and had worked through that.
I can't imagine you wouldn't have tremendous anger as you were writing the book.
Just probably more questions. Why? Why did we have to live this way? Why did my mom treat us this way? Why did she allow things to happen? And what I figured out is I needed to stop asking why, because I was never going to get an answer. I needed to figure out how can I take that experience and not let it cripple me.
Your mother was only a real serious factor in your life for what, about the first 5-6 years?
Yeah, about the five or six years she was around. And she was, you know, gone a lot and, you know, on drugs a lot. But, you know, that was my mom. And no matter how bad things were, my mom was queen of the world. And no matter how bad things were, that's just the way we saw her.
Well, of course you would. Yeah, she's your mother, you know, there's no doubt about it. But you write that your older brother, who's only older by 2 years old, by the time he's five, he's taking care of the kids.
Yeah, he did. You know, he did a lot. He was a survivor. He tried to protect us and fend for us. And he understood his role as a big brother at that time. He stepped in and fed us when we were hungry, did the best he could.
Eventually, though, you moved in with your grandparents. And if that sounded like, okay, maybe a respite, there was just as much chaos around the grandparents' house as, maybe not quite as much, with the exception of your grandfather, who was this amazing man who was like this oasis in this huge maelstrom of chaos that went on in this house. Because your grandfather and your grandmother, utterly two different people. Grandmother was equally in chaos. She had sons that she doted on who were, if not in prison, were committing acts that could put them in prison, and literally abusing your siblings and later some cousins too.
Yeah. My grandparents, my grandmother, my grandfather, and my mom had an interesting relationship anyway. So when my grandmother would get upset with my mom, she would call DHS and file reports to get us in trouble. and vice versa. So when we moved into my grandparents' house, that's their relationship. Mom would get mad at grandma and she would say, oh, they're abusing the children. And those things, even as a kid, bothered me that why do y'all have to, if we're in danger, why are you only waiting until you're angry before you call DHS? And DHS, I mean, they probably got called once a week from someone in our family.
How many times do you think you had interactions with DHS during your whole growing up period?
Probably more times, you know, up until I left, probably more times than I can count. I mean, between DHS and the police.
Monthly, weekly, sometimes weekly?
Oh, yeah, sometimes a couple times a week, sometimes, you know, maybe once a month, but more times than I could count of interactions with DHS or the police come into our house, especially at my grandparents' house. The police were there all the time dealing with my uncles and criminal behavior, and then my oldest brother started getting in trouble a little bit as well, too. So the police were at our house more often than not.
Really? And yet it took so many trips before they actually removed you from the house.
That's one of those things it's hard to understand why it took so much. You know, my heart, I guess I wanted to be there with my family. The other side wanted so bad to be gone or the pain and suffering to stop. And I think even then, if people would have asked me, you know, especially when during the abuse, would you like to leave? I would have said no. It wasn't until I felt alienated.
But you weren't actually asked any during those times.
No, never asked. I think we just assume. And again,
now occasionally you'd go to a temporary shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And but very quickly back into one home or the other.
Absolutely. And, you know, we could talk about the system all day, and I think it's getting better. But there's a fine line between splitting kids up. That's hard. Who can take five children, especially the way we were, our culture and the way we functioned? It would be very difficult to handle five kids. And I definitely think there's some pros in keeping kids together, but also there's some negatives that sometimes the older sibling can influence one that's trying to make better choices. But just going in and out of those shelters, that's difficult, a traumatic experience every time you come in and out. You have a sense of rejection that when you go somewhere and you think, oh, I'm going to stay here, and then you're taken away, and that's hard. You learn not to trust anybody, no matter how credible they are. So our trust issues, especially when you're a foster kid, that's where those things come from.
Yeah. Now, this was in what, the late 80s, mid-80s?
Yeah, started in the 70s up to 80s when I got placed at my grandparents'. It was about 1978, 79 when I went to my grandparents.
Of course, there have been a lot of changes in DHS in that time. But still, these are questions that the caseworkers are always grappling with. Do I leave kids in a home? Or do I put them in the system? Because there are negative consequences either way they went.
Yeah. And I'd like to think that DHS, I mean, and in my case, they just made a bad choice. I have to think now that she thought she was doing what was best. Doesn't make any sense. That's one of those questions that, you know, trying to search for answers for, I will probably never get an answer.
Now, at one point, they housed you at Lloyd Rader,
yes,
which is west of Sand Springs, which was, I always thought it was basically a prison for kids.
That's pretty much what it was like.
But you hadn't committed any crimes, had you? What, was it just a matter of that this was the only place they could find a bed?
I think it was placement. I think the system was so flooded with kids that's where I got sent.
And that was perhaps one of the most poignant stories in the book, was you talk about having spent Christmas in Lloyd Rader, and kids' families were coming. And you were hoping that at least your grandparents would come, and you waited pretty much all day. Never happened.
You know, and part of me thought that someone would come, and then there was another part of me felt like they were still mad at me because I'd gotten my Uncle Stevie thrown in jail. And so my heart was broke. I felt isolated and alone again. And again, that played into sort of trust issues, that if you can't trust your own family to come visit you on a holiday, I mean—
yeah.
So that really bothered me for a long time.
Now, you mentioned you had your uncle thrown in jail. There were these three uncles, and one was probably smoking a lot of marijuana and keeping to himself. Another one was very abusive when he was drunk. And I guess the other one was sort of somewhat abusive as well. But the Stevie was the one that really was beating on the kids, and eventually you just had enough and you reported him.
Yeah, he, for whatever reason, I was the target kid. So I was the crybaby, emotional kid that everybody made fun of. And so that's seen as a sign of weakness. Even my older brother, who was being an older brother, he wasn't trying to be mean. They were all trying to toughen me up. And so Stevie didn't like it that I was an emotional crybaby. And so he took a lot of his anger out on me. And, you know, when I refused to drink alcohol, he had had enough, so he threw me downstairs and, you know, stomped on me and broke my ribs, and I called the police and got him arrested. People ask me all the time, man, that took a lot of courage. Well, when I was a kid, I would tell you that I was a coward. That's why I left, because I wasn't tough enough to take it.
You were sane enough not to take it, actually.
But that's what I thought. I thought I was too weak. I felt guilty that I wasn't man enough to handle this abuse that we were all going through.
Wow. You mentioned it was one of the things when Stevie got drunk, he would have you pour out a big glass of liquor and he basically force you to drink it.
And, you know, again, it's that teaching trying to make us men and tough.
Wow.
And in my mind, really, after all I'd been through, I didn't think I needed to be tough.
And so at that point, that was the place where you severed ties with the family, within the family, that house, which you mentioned said constantly had police cars, DHS people looking at that. And yet nothing was really happening to change the outcome for the kids and the family.
Absolutely. There was no, you know, my grandfather worked. He worked very hard to provide for this very dysfunctional family. My grandmother battled with depression, and she sort of fought that with drinking. And so she felt this crippling compassion for her sons that were living there. And it just didn't help but perpetuate the culture that we were living in. And so we were by ourselves. You couldn't tell grandma on her sons because you couldn't. They were right no matter what. And if they were being mean to us, it was to make men or, you know, adults out of us. And so we felt like we were by ourselves. On the flip side, when you go to school, it's not like you go to school and say, hey, here's what's happening at home. That's the ultimate betrayal.
Yeah. My guest today is Alton Carter, author of the Oklahoma Book Award winning book for young adults, The Boy Who Carried Bricks. We're not even to that part of the story yet. It's an amazing story of how he came through this unbelievable childhood in poverty, with abuse in his homes, abuse in foster care, and has come through and has made an amazing life. Well, Alton, after you turned in your uncle to the police, you had to leave home. And so you went to a succession of shelters and foster homes. And it doesn't make people who watch the system from afar feel any better that you suffered some level of abuse in most of those foster homes as well at the time.
You know, absolutely. None of them were perfect. None of my foster parents were perfect. The Boys Ranch was a trying experience. A ranch dad was very abusive. In fact, the title The Boy Who Carried Bricks came from, one of the punishments he made us do was carry bricks. And again, he thought he was making us tough. In my mind, he thought he was doing what he needed to help us be successful. It was just wrong.
But he was sadistic, though.
Absolutely.
There's scenes out of the bridge over River Kwai where he's like having you guys stand at attention in the hot sun all day because somebody broke a
Toilet paper holder?
The toilet paper holder. Yeah. He has you stand out in the sun for 8 hours at attention.
Yes, trying to make us tough. And people ask me all the time, why did you stay? Why didn't you leave the Boys Ranch? And here's what I remember thinking. It's better than home. What did I have to go back to? I go back to a family that didn't care about me. And, you know, one thing I love to mention is one of the reasons why I left was because of a fourth grade teacher who made me feel like I was somebody. And so I felt like her, when a teacher kicked me out of her class, Miss Thompson saying, hey, I'll take him, that, I believe that was the courage. That's where it came from to leave.
That was an important person in your life. It was a fourth grade or fifth grade?
Fourth grade.
Yeah, fourth grade. You were in trouble in your class, and the teacher was having trouble with you and would send you out in the hall. She finally had enough with you, and the teacher across the hall basically says, well, I'll take him in. And basically she told you that you were special, that you were you know, you had good in you. And that was probably the first time you'd heard that in some time.
First time I felt it. I mean, first time I felt like, and again, that in itself was new. So I didn't really understand what was happening. I mean, it felt good, but I didn't know what it was. And then it would be temporary, like the happy moments, that at some point she's not going to care about me and view me like everyone else.
In fact, she was asking you why you, you know, you were not doing what you needed to be doing. And then you said something which, you know, you brought race into the conversation. You said, well, you just treated me this way because I'm black. And then she had the ultimate rejoinder to you.
Absolutely.
Tell us that story.
That was the culture of our family, that we were taught to hate white people, police, and teachers because they were a threat to our family. That all of those entities or professions had an influence, or not had power, but they had the ability to sort of disrupt our function. And so her teaching me that race was not an issue. So one day I was acting up and she made me miss recess, and she came in and asked me if I knew I was missing recess. Well, my answer should have been because of my behavior. But what I responded to was, well, you're making me miss recess because I'm black. So she ran out of the classroom crying, not because I hurt her feelings, but I think she just saw that there was a wall put up, and she tried her very best to connect with me. And so she ran out of the classroom crying, and a couple of days later I was playing in the front yard, and she showed up with her husband, and she said, Alton, I want you to meet somebody. And when she said, I want you to meet my husband, I took off running because I thought, well, I made you cry. Your husband's going to get me. And so I turned around, and her husband got out of the car, and he was black. Now, Miss Thompson never once said, see, Alton, look, this has nothing to do with race. She never gave me that speech. It wasn't until I was an adult that it registered, or I understood exactly what she was teaching me. And so today, my message is behavior has nothing to do with the color of your skin. It's a choice. I was acting up because I was hurting. I don't know if you've ever seen Box Trolls, but there's a quote in a movie that says, sometimes when a heart is broken, it grows back crooked. And I think when I heard that, it was me. That book was talking about me as an adult. Of course, it was just a few years ago it came out.
Yeah.
But it helped me realize that my heart had been broken and it had grown back crooked. I didn't know how to love people, much less have people love me. I didn't know what that was like.
Yeah. Eventually, though, you're still going through school. You're not dropping out. Mm-hmm. You're getting through school. Perhaps Miss Thompson played a role in that, but you're going through school. You go through this stint at this Lions Club of Ranch, which you had tremendously abusive people there. But you move around. The guy that was fired from the ranch eventually for being abusive, you were placed in his foster home for a few days. But eventually you found a family in Cushing that was raising foster kids. And you got a great foster family, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Again, they weren't perfect. My foster parents weren't perfect, but they were better than home, and they never mistreated me in Cushing. I got to eat. You know, when I left, probably the boys' ranch was the last stay of abuse. My foster home in Boley, Oklahoma wasn't the greatest. It was a small apartment, and my bedroom was just barely a closet. When I went to Cushing, it was a foster parents. I had my own bed. They fed me every day. They treated me like a human being.
And that was, I mean, it sounds like that was about as good of an experience as you ever had in your life.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there were some ups and downs, especially with myself not trusting people. But every extent, every place that I went to, teachers showed up. So in Perkins at the boys' ranch, when I hated myself and I hated the town and I hated the place that I lived in, I had this ag teacher, Mr. Jennings, who wore these coveralls and hat crooked and chewed tobacco back then. But that guy was absolutely amazing. I mean, he made me feel like I belonged, and I knew it. I knew it.
You know, that's perhaps one of the best stories out of this book is, one, how the system repeatedly failed you, yet you came out okay. And two is the effects a few dedicated teachers had in your life. What difference did it make in your life?
Huge. It gave me the confidence to believe in myself. And again, sometimes these things don't show up till later. So I think these teachers and people gave me seeds of hope. So Ms. Thompson gave me the seed of compassion and acceptance. Mr. Jennings, that, hey, you're just like everyone else, regardless of the color of your skin. Because in Perkins, I was the only black kid in an all-white school. And Mr. Jennings taught me that in high school. I had a football coach who told me that I was better than quitting, that I had other options than to quit because I wasn't playing. A science teacher who taught me perseverance. I'll never forget that she sat me down and said, I know you're a foster kid, but I don't care. You're going to do your homework. You're going to turn in your papers. And she believed in me. And not only that, but when I wasn't doing what I was supposed to, she made me come in class and do my homework. And so she taught me that I could do it. When my whole entire time in school, I always thought that I was too dumb. I always thought that. And she gave me the confidence. And so there were a whole bunch of people that poured into me. You know, there's this African phrase that says Ubuntu, and it means I am because you are. And I believe that I'm successful. I've accomplished a whole bunch of things because there were a whole bunch of people behind me doing their part to help me heal and grow and become who I am today.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you do today, especially since the book came out, is you go to schools and talk to them. Do you run into more Altons wherever you go?
Everywhere I go, I run. And, you know, it's not about race. It's not about economics. I run into Altons or people with the same experience everywhere I go. In fact, I'll do some staff developments for companies, and same response. I'll have people come up and say, you know, my life wasn't as bad as yours, but I finally feel like somebody knows how I feel. And that's the beginning part of healing, is just understanding that you weren't alone. And all too often, we keep those things to ourselves. But yeah, I get to go to high schools, and, you know, some high schools I'll go talk. And if there's a group of 500, there's been as many of 100 kids that will line up and share one bit how they connected with my story.
You write a little bit in the book, and you've also talked a lot about learning to trust other people. Has that been the toughest thing as an adult, to sort of gain trust in your intimate, private relationships with people? Has that been the toughest thing?
It is. It's still a struggle. I just have to be conscious that it's an issue versus pretending that it's not there. So that was the first step, is acknowledging that I have trust issues. Well, who wants to admit that you're flawed? And so once I overcame that, hey, Alton, you have trust issues. So I think I tend to trust people too much and then all of a sudden want to run once I realized how close they are. And so that's been a huge issue to overcome. The other side of that is I realized that I had a bigger issue trusting myself than other people. That I didn't trust my judgment. I didn't trust that I was capable of being a good husband, a good father. And so that was a bigger issue for me to overcome.
Yeah. Well, you do have, it sounds like you have a great family, helping others in your ministry at First Methodist Church in Stillwater, and doing great. It's an amazing story that you tell in this book, The Boy Who Carried Bricks. And I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Alton Carter is the Oklahoma Book Award-winning author of The Boy Who Carried Bricks, and he's one of three authors which will be featured at the Chapters evening at the Hardesty Regional Library on Thursday, September 8th. It's a fundraiser for the library's Ruth G. Hardman Adult Literacy Service. The deadline for reservations is September 1st. You can learn more at 918-549-7494. Well, next week, Studio Tulsa will be taking a hiatus for the end of the summer, and we'll be presenting conversations from the 2016 Aspen Ideas Festival. Some very provocative ideas and discussions. Join us at a special time, 11 next week, and then Studio Tulsa will return the day after Labor Day with new programs. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.